is Edwin Whiting interviewing Don Halsey for the first time at his place of business on the 9th of April, 1990. Mr. Halsey, what service were you in?
Okay, I was in the Army.
So why did you join the Army?
Well, it was during the time right after I graduated from Texas Tech that they were drafting everybody. And I decided to go ahead and enlist before I got drafted. So I enlisted so I could get what I wanted.
Vietnam was you knew about it, you expected to be there at the time?
Yeah, in fact, just before I graduated from Tech, all the guys in the fraternity I was in, everybody, we had Marines and Navy, Air Force, and all this, and everybody in my age group at that time, it was just assumed that we would be going to the military just as soon as we graduated.
Did you have a family at this time?
No, I was a single guy.
When did you go to Vietnam?
Okay, I was in Vietnam April of 1970 to April of 1971.
Were you stationed in the country?
The first part of it, I was located in a place called Tan An in the Mekong Delta, which is 30 miles south of Saigon. And for about the last 9 or so months, I was up in Quang Nai Province, up in I Corps.
What were the good living conditions like?
In the Delta, because of the type of work I was doing, counterintelligence work, I wore civilian clothes, and I lived in a French chateau, and I ran an agent net across the border into Cambodia. But the last 9 months, up in Quang Nai Province, I put the uniform back on, and I lived in a Vietnamese compound. I was an advisor to the Vietnamese out in the villages. Pretty rough.
What was the food like?
Let's see. Ate a lot of rice paper, eel, water buffalo, lots and lots and lots of rice of every kind that they would do. Whenever we'd get an airlift in, we'd eat steaks and stuff.
How often were you supported by other arms of the supporting arms of the services of Vietnam?
We had a few Marine snipers that would stay with us. We had an Army helicopter come and bring mail out to us. But otherwise, it was all Vietnamese in our area. There weren't any American units.
Pretty much the boonies.
And the boonies.
What were your duties like?
Okay, I was in counterintelligence, and I basically, as I said, when I was in the Delta, I ran an agent net across the border into Cambodia. I was an agent handler for Vietnamese sources in the area. They would go out and report Viet Cong activity in the jungle. Later, when I went up north to Quang Nai Province, I was in a program that gained a lot of notoriety. It was called the Phoenix Phung Wong Program. And the Phoenix Program was a CIA-backed organization that was responsible for rooting out the Viet Cong political cadre in the villages.
What did that entail for you? Did that put you in danger? Or?
It was pretty strange because there'd be myself and another American and two Australian advisors. We'd go out with Vietnamese regional popular forces. They were called Rough Puffs. And we used to go out with them, and we'd have certain communist cadre targeted in villages. And we would go out and basically kidnap them, or worse. And I would go along and help make all the plans and the organizational methods. One of the deals that we worked with that we gave a lot of intelligence information to was what they call the Provincial Reconnaissance Units, or PRUs. These were Hmong mercenaries, Hmongs from Laos, and they worked for the American government, and they'd go out and take care of the Viet Cong cadre a lot, good deal of the time.
Were the Hmongs and the Vietnamese reliable?
Yes, the Hmongs were extremely, extremely reliable. Just like the Hill people you heard during the Green Beret revolt the Montagnards. The Montagnards and the Nungs were extremely reliable. The ethnic Vietnamese, if you can call them ethnic, hated them, but all the Americans liked them.
What was a typical day? What did you do on just an average day?
Okay, on an average day, a lot of it was check-in, what we call our Phoenix target folders of known communist agents in the villages, and working with the Vietnamese counterpart in organizing search operations. A lot of times we go off and cordon off villages, and then we go in and check ID cards of the VC or sympathizers, because over there, like you've heard, seeing the movies, you never knew who was who. A lot of times it didn't really end up that way, because we'd run into a lot of combat with kind of VC cadre, and they would go down their tunnels and stuff, and so we'd have to try to close off all the tunnels. An interesting thing on the villages when we used to do the sweeps was that you'd see them run off, and of course by the time you got in the village and stuff, it was just old men, women and kids, just like you see in the movies.
They knew you were coming?
They knew we were coming. It was real interesting because the Vietnamese compound, there's a little Vietnamese girl that she would fix our food. She was kind of a secretary and everything. So one day we went out and found her body laying out by the road. And everybody thought, gee, what happened to her? And the Vietnamese said, you didn't know, but she was a double agent. She was trying to lead a sapper attack against us. So you just never knew who was who.
What were the people like that you served? You mentioned the Australians.
The Australians, I thought they were a neat bunch of people. They were real cocky. They liked to drink their Foster's Lager Kangaroo beer. They were all professional soldiers. They weren't draftees like a lot of Americans. I'm not so sure they felt liked it. It's such a good cause to be in Vietnam in the first place. But they made the most of it. They'd go out on ambush sites at night and come in. The rest of us would have to go to sleep, and they'd end up, you know, drinking beer, throwing darts, fighting. You know, they're just singing Waltzing Matilda. They were a good group of people. They were real fun, a real hearty bunch of folks to be with. The South Vietnamese themselves, when I went over, I didn't detect anything was wrong. But after I was there for a while, I got to the point I didn't like them. I think they just didn't have the heart and the soul and the mind to really follow through with it. In the middle of the day, they'd take a siesta. You never knew what was going on. A lot of them had brothers and sisters that were on the other side of the Viet Cong. And part of the reason is it all comes out, the reason the South Vietnamese weren't that reliable is because their own government and their own high officials were pretty corrupt themselves. So, you know, they were just in trying to survive. So they were really caught in a bad spot. You had a foreign force like the Americans over there. You had their own officials that are somewhat corrupt. And then you had the Viet Cong that felt like they were traced to a country. So they just really didn't have much of a will to fight or to stick with it. The Viet Cong and the NVA, as you know, they were pretty tenacious. They would load rice up on a bicycle, push it across mountains and be gone for 8 to 10 months at a time. They were, as much as we hate to say it, we always used to have a lot more respect for the VC because we knew that they were dangerous and knew what they were going to do, but with our allies, we didn't really know what was going to happen. And then likewise, on the other hand, I think, on a personal opinion, I think that at the end of the war, we kind of sold them down the river too, in a way, but that's just a personal opinion. as far as dealing with Americans, the infantry units we were all about the same. There were a lot of rear echelon types that had a pretty easy time during the war, nothing to take away from them. But I think we had a small combat unit and a huge support outfit that, you know, just a, you know, big tail and a little bit of teeth. We all were just kind of in the same boat. It was real strange what we felt like. I remember sitting out in the jungle under a tree, and it was raining, and I felt real kind of sorry for myself, because here I was over there doing this, and the VC were trying to kill you, the South Vietnamese hated you, and the people back home didn't seem to care anymore by this time, so all we had was ourselves, so it built a lot of comradeship.
What was the most exciting thing that happened to you over there? What stands out the most in your mind experience-wise?
I think the most exciting thing that happened was when our scout dog had puppies. No, just kidding. When we went on an operation into a tunnel complex area in the village, that was pretty hairy. And on another side, I sort of enjoyed flying around on helicopters. I thought the helicopters were pretty neat. But that was probably the most exciting thing. Went into a village and there's a tunnel complex, and this area was heavily landmined, and we took a lot of casualties that day with the Vietnamese. They stepped on a lot of landmines, and we kind of pulled them out of the VC, out of bunkers, and we drove a farmer's water buffaloes through this field and let them take the mine problem. But that was pretty exciting.
You mentioned tunnels. Did you have to go down inside of them?
I didn't. The Vietnamese did it. For one thing, the Americans are so much bigger than your Vietnamese and stuff, we wouldn't have fit in a tunnel. Plus, the Americans are kind of claustrophobic overall, whereas the Vietnamese are used to it because they'd been building those tunnels since the French were there in the early 50s. And we just had no idea how extensive the tunnel system was. Some of the tunnels would stretch for 20 miles, and now there's a book out, it's called The Tunnels of Coochee, and it's an excellent book on the account of the tunnel rants and the tunnel system. But some of you could send whole battalions of the enemy through these. They had their own medical corps, they had their own entertainers, like their equivalent of Bob Hope, that would entertain them, and all this is underground. It was just amazing. But no, we never had to go down into them. The Vietnamese would go down. We used to just throw smoke bombs or grenades into the opening. And as we know now, the way the thing was dug, you know, it didn't have any impact at all. But we thought we were heroes.
Were drugs a problem?
Among American units, I think there were. With the Vietnamese, because we all had Vietnamese counterparts, they thought it was a loss of face to use drugs. So any of the Americans that I was with, they never touched them, including myself. But I know that in a lot of the rear areas and stuff, the MPs would have to go in and you know, take care of this drug problem. I know of cases of Americans that seen used to have heroin tracks all over their arm, but you know, I didn't know them or anything. I just, you know, could see them when I go to an American base. But as I said, I was out in Vietnamese villages and little outposts, and no drugs were any problem with us. Yeah, alcohol might have been something else. One of the things that was real peculiar over there is you couldn't get any Cokes or soft drinks because the Vietnamese would steal them off the docks and put them on the black market, so we never got them. And you couldn't drink the water because you'd get immediate dysentery. So, like a fool, I'd been there 2 weeks and brushed my teeth with the water and I got dysentery extremely bad. but there wasn't any problem with getting beer in all the time. So I think that sometimes that could have been a problem. It was so hot over there, 120, 130 degrees, that you sweated so much, you could drink 25 or 30 cans of beer in a day and you wouldn't feel a thing because it would just go right through you. And some people said, I can't believe y'all drank that much beer. Well, the deal is, if you can't drink anything, if you can't drink the water and you don't have any Cokes, what are you going to drink? So everybody drank beer. But I'm sure that, some people have used it, just like you've seen in the movies. I'd say probably alcohol was probably more of a problem than drugs at that time.
When you were with the Vietnamese, what kind of medical services did you have?
Oh, let's see. Just had a Vietnamese medic, that was it. And we had, of course, the radio to call in a dust off, you know, the evacs, the medical evacuation helicopters if you got into a bind. There were American bases north of us about 50 miles that they could get helicopters in to get us out if we needed help.
Did you lose a lot of manpower to stuff like dysentery?
Not too much. We took a white pill every Monday and a red pill every day for malaria. But most of us still got malaria somehow or another. We got it. Basically, up the area where I was, the worst thing was probably landmines. The last week before I came home, out of about 40 people, we lost 28 killed due to landmines. So that was a problem. But as far as illness, we all seemed to do pretty well.
How did you deal with the mining?
It was real strange because it was the so-called hidden enemy. Everything would be all right, and then all of a sudden, you'd hear one go off, kind of a whomp. And then you'd hear one of the guys screaming and hollering. You'd go back, and a large part of his leg would be missing, and you tried to stop the bleeding. It was enough to make you mad because you didn't know where to strike out, you know, being human nature. But the area in Quang Nai Province was heavily, heavily mined. A lot of farmers would be killed and stuff just out in a rice paddy because of all the mining. I'm sure probably a lot of people are getting blown away up there now. And just because of the mines. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
Okay. The reason I said hi to her is because she was worked with the Americans over in Vietnam, her family. So that's another thing here. We have several Vietnamese working here at the plant. And we always get in these discussions about stuff. And it's kind of funny, you know, because we lived with them and everything. They're a little bit closer to us, I think, a lot of people. Okay.
All right. Race relations a problem?
Race relations, like within the Americans themselves?
The American.
Yeah, they were. Going over on the plane, I was thinking about this the other day. We had some blacks and some whites on the plane that got into it, yelling at each other on the plane going over. So as soon as we left Oakland, we landed in Honolulu, and the MPs came and got probably 10 to 12 people off the plane, anybody that was involved in it, you know, whether you were Korean, American, or whatever, and just took them off the plane. There was a lot of racial problems over there. It was really hard to understand because where I was with the Americans, we had quite a few blacks that stayed with us, and you know, all of us that were with the Vietnamese were just totally colorblind. I can't even place who was black and who was white now, you know, thinking back. But I know on the American bases it was a real problem. I went to Coochie, is an American fire base, and the major there said, "We have a curfew at 8:30." And I said, "Boy, the VC must be bad around here." He said, "No, because we've been having racial fights and stuff every night. So we got a curfew because of that." But with American units, I think it was pretty bad.
When you were serving in I Corps, what was the difference between what did you do there compared to what you did in Delta?
Okay, Delta, as I said, we wore civilian clothes, and we carried identification cards as American agricultural specialists. And so we thought we were real cool being James Bond. You know, we wore these civilian clothes and drove a civilian Jeep around. And what we did is, it's just like in the movies, we would contact certain loyal South Vietnamese, recruit them to be our agent, and send them across the border to Cambodia to gather intelligence for us. I was personally an agent handler for 12 different agents. Some of them are double agents, just like in the movies. They'd go get information and come back and tell us where the Viet Cong and the NVA were. That was real effective. I also had to sign a, just like in the movies again, terminate with extreme prejudice, CIA term. This one girl, that she's about 22, that worked for us, we thought she was reliable, and she planned this operation for these provincial reconnaissance unit folks to go into Cambodia, and she was a double agent for the VC, and she set up an ambush, and it killed all 80 of them, and so we got to terminate her. We got to, with extreme prejudice, which means, you know, you just, in simple terms, you blow them away. Up in the northern part, hi Gene.
Hi.
Up in the northern part, I was in uniform. This was the Phoenix Fung Wong program, and it wasn't so much running agents net, but again, it was targeting the VC political commissars and cadres in the hamlets and villages. And here's your difference. The first one, again, was running an agent net. The second was targeting, you know, the political apparatus for elimination.
How did it affect you knowing that so many of your Vietnamese support personnel were double agents?
It bothered me for a while, and then after a while we didn't think twice about it. For us, it just got to be day-to-day living. You know, well, who's gonna show their true colors today or tomorrow? But there were quite a few of them that, you know, worked both sides of it. Yeah, I guess it's, yeah, quite a few. After a while, we just got used to it.
Do you have to deal with any direct attacks from the NVA or the Viet Cong?
Yeah. The first night that I got into Vietnam, it was just a big station to send people, deploy them throughout the country. It was a placement station at Long Bend. And the first night I was there, we had a SAPR attack, and a bunch of them got through the wire. That was our first night there. There was that. A lot of the operations that when I was up in I Corps, we didn't get attacked directly, but when we go out on operations, there was always some contact with the VC or the NVA, so we were always involved in it.
When you were in the Delta, what was your chain of command? Was it military or not, CIA?
Okay, the chain of command, we had a major that operated in Saigon, and he would give us our orders. And, of course, he was in full uniform, but again, we were in civilian clothing. and we'd get our orders from him on things that we needed to do. That was about it. I lived in this town called Tanan in an old French chateau the French had built in the mid-50s. And then outside of town, about a half a mile, was the 3rd Brigade of the 9th Infantry Division. And we would go out there a lot and go to movies. But we had a real, real loose liaison with the Army. We really they weren't our authority, and we didn't have any authority. Our major guy was in Saigon.
Did the American troops in the area treat you differently? Because you were in civilian clothes?
Yeah, they did. They kept calling us the spooks, or some of them, well, gosh, these guys have these cushy government jobs. I wish I could be a civilian. So, you know, that was good for us because I guess it was effective. Maybe we didn't act like the Army. But, yeah, they treated us differently. And a lot of them would stay around us. If you'd go into the bar or go eat or something, they'd kind of stray away from you because they either thought you were a spook, being an intelligence type, or you were a criminal investigation division, you were investigating drug usage. So they stayed away.
Does that bother you?
No. That was to be expected. Went with the territory. Nature of the beast.
What was the countryside of Vietnam like?
The Delta was beautiful. I really thought the Delta was pretty. You had lots of hedgerows and you had canals, water running all the way through it. It was really pretty, and the people in the Delta were really a nice bunch of people. The locals were real friendly. The kids were real friendly. And the Delta was just gorgeous with all the palm trees and everything. And up in I-Corps, it was flat in the area we were at, the little towns. But if you looked off in the distance, they had the mountains. And the mountains and jungles and stuff, and that's where the NVA and the VC were in their caves and stuff up in the mountains. The Delta was really pretty. There were several times I went into Da Nang and China Beach, not like the show, but China Beach was gorgeous, one of the most beautiful beaches I've ever seen in the world. I've been to Vung Tau on the coast for counterintelligence training over there, the Phoenix program. It was gorgeous, and I think that country would do well to open up a resort over there. I mean, they could do well, but it's just great. I think the whole country is just beautiful. It's dazzling. It's just as green as it can be. It rains all the time. Up north, during monsoon season, it rained and rained and rained so much that the water got up to our necks. So we had to sleep in the trees and stuff for about a week. And you could see the snakes swimming around in it. You know, that whole area just flooded in monsoon season.
Snakes a problem?
You had to watch out for them. You'd come across a dead Vietnamese farmer out in the field and in a rice paddy, and you'd look and there'd be two little snake bite holes down by his ankle. And, you know, he'd been out there and a snake got him. And they had some that were called the walking death, because if you got bit, take a few steps and that'd be it. So you had to watch out for them. I know a lot of the American units and stuff that we come across carried mongooses with them, because the mongoose liked humans. They carry on their back and they'd go out and get the snakes. So they were pretty good. What was interesting, you asked me about coming across with Americans. Since I wasn't with American units, I wouldn't see many Americans for months at a time. And there was one day that we were out tromping through the jungle on an operation. And so we came across a platoon of the AmeriCal Division, the infamous Cali AmeriCal Division. And so we decided to have some sea rations out in the field. And I was sitting there eating. This guy came out and said, "Don, how are you doing?" I turned around and looked. It was this guy I used to sit next to in one of those monster history classes at Tech. And we studied together and had no idea. And here we were out in the middle of the jungle and came across. So that was kind of an interesting thing.
Did Did you have any sort of R&R?
Yep. Had weeks of R&R. I went to Sydney, Australia. By that time, all of us felt like that we didn't want to see any more Orientals. We wanted to see the round eyes, as we used to say then. And we wanted to head to Australia because we had these big visions of these tall blondes with blue eyes and hanging out in string bikinis on the beach. And so we all went to Australia. And I thought Australia was just unbelievable. This is a place most of us will never get to go back and visit. And Australia was wonderful. Australia, they had an R&R center there that they arranged things for GIs. And it was tremendous because for like $2 or $3, you could go out on a floating disco in the harbor. They'd have a boat with all the food and beer you wanted to drink or anything else you wanted to drink. And they stopped by on a red double-decker bus like they did in England. They picked up all these secretaries and stuff downtown, and they went out. Everybody danced and laughed and just really had a great time. I went out to the University of Sydney. I wanted to get away from the usual GI haunts, the bars and stuff. So I went out to the University of Sydney and visited with some professors. And I even sat through several classes out there and visited with students. Went over to their equivalent of our student union building, had a sandwich, and talked to them. That was a good relief to get away from the war. Went out to a sheep ranch, rode horses. So the R&R was just tremendous. In fact, I liked Australia so much that when my tour service was up, I really thought about migrating back to Australia. At that time, they needed teachers very badly. Had all my teaching credentials. Had done my student teaching and my degree. Really thought about going back to Australia and being a teacher. And then I had a week's leave. Looking back on it now, I should have gone to Taiwan. Should have gone to Hong Kong or some other place on R&R, but I didn't feel like that I needed to leave my buddies out in the field, so I didn't take a week's leave. I just spent that 1 week on R&R.
What did you do in country entertainment?
Down in the Delta, we'd go out to the 9th Infantry Division base camp, and I'd go to the officers' club. And we'd look at movies and drink beer and eat hamburgers. And they'd have touring floor shows of Australian girls, girls from the Philippines, and some American groups that would come through there. Up north in I Corps, we had a little American team advisory house, and we had a 16-millimeter projector, and a helicopter would bring movies in. And we'd look at about one movie every night. And that's just about the extent of entertainment in country. When we go to Da Nang, we'd go to China Beach every once in a while and hang out on the beach for a while. Because of the nature of work that I was in, I was involved with people in MACSOG, which is Special Operations Group. And these guys were all Green Beret volunteers. They do a lot of third country operations and stuff that nobody would mention. And so those guys live well, so we just go to the beach with them.
This is kind of a redundant question, but we
sure.
Ask anyway. How are your relations with the Vietnamese people, civilians and army?
How were they then? To be real honest with you, as much as I hate to say it, and in part of it is the psychology of the war, that after I was over there for a while, all of us kind of had to fight to keep our humanness, so to speak, because of the brutality of it. You got to the point that you hated the Vietnamese period, both friendlies and the enemy. You resented them. I just kind of kept my mouth closed a whole bunch, but I got to the point that I hated them. And I, looking back on it, I don't know why I hated them. You know, they were just poor people caught up in a war. And we were all caught. I guess it was due because they were all seemed to be on the take for money Their discipline was so lax while Americans were trying to fight the war for them, or that was our perception. And I'm sure, you know, since being away from it is our perception. The tension between the Americans and the Vietnamese toward the end was really terrible. One of the Americans just lost his cool and pulled out a 45 and said he was going to kill our Vietnamese interpreter, and we tackled him and rolled around and took the gun away from him and just stuff like that. And it got to be really, really tense that the Vietnamese, here we were in their compound, some of these guys are real rednecks, not very well educated. Americans would put a sign that says no dinks or gooks allowed. And here we were on their compound. And, you know, I thought that was a really, really wrong. But I also, I resented them. I was also, in the last few months when I was there, here's an operation in Laos called Lamson 19, I think it was. And this is called a helicopter war. It came out on Time and Newsweek. And the Vietnamese were airlifted by American helicopters into Laos. And the strange thing about it, you probably read all the things about how they grabbed a hold of the helicopter skids and wouldn't fight and tried to get out. Well, it was during this time that the feeling toward the Vietnamese was so strong that all of us said, this is the beginning of the end. Look for this government to collapse in a few years. And, you know, because they don't have any hearts and minds for the fighting of it. And it just made us that more resentful toward them. I tried to keep a cool head as much as I could toward the Vietnamese, but I just, toward the end, got to the point I hated them. But then after I got away, and away from the military, I started thinking back about it, and, you know, how would you act, you know, if you were caught in the same mess? You know, they were okay, it's just their government was screwed up, you know, and gosh, and I think basically what the Americans did, they corrupted them. You read so much about how high the prostitution rate was over there. Well, I think the average pay in a Vietnamese family at that time was like equivalent to about $2 a month for working in the rice paddies, and they were starving because they'd been driven from their land because of the war. But there was always a readily available American troops. So these girls could make an awful lot of money and take the money back to their families. And I think that a lot of them turned to prostitution for it. And unfortunately, it ruined a lot of families because the Vietnamese religion and their culture was very, very strict and very puritanical. But you just had prostitutes everywhere. Everywhere. You'd walk around in Saigon, they'd grab you in an alley. I went into a department store in Saigon, and a prostitute, hey, G.I., pulls her dress up. You know, this right in the middle of a department store. In the Vietnamese villages that we were in, we'd be right out in the middle of a jungle and hear this burn, and we'd look, and here comes some Honda motor scooters with these Arvins with a girl on the back trying to sell us girls out in the field. And it was really sad. It's what you saw in the movie Full Metal Jacket with Arvin and the girl, that's real typical of it. Speaking of prostitutes, what was interesting, the type of work I was in, that seemed to be the best place to get information was the cat houses. You'd go in and, you know, you'd buy them some soup and say, look, I'm not here for your line of business, but I need to know where the Americans are in this area, who their commanding officers are. You'd also go in and you would ask where the VC, who are their officers, how many men they have, where's the NVA, what's going to happen. And from this you could formulate intelligence plans because the cat houses were used by Americans and Vietnamese and also the enemy also. So you knew everything going on. So it was real strange to go into these places to buy information.
How did it bother you when you went out into a field in a combat situation with the Vietnamese troops? Did it as you said, didn't really care for.
Yeah, it did, but there wasn't anything else that we could do. So we just went. Still okay? Okay. Yeah, I just never really trusted him. I know if we really got into a really bad situation, we'd probably have it, because they'd probably leave, take off, run, or whatever.
Did you have any problems with the South Vietnamese taking pot shots at the advisors? Or?
No, no problems with that at all. Each of us had counterparts. My counterpart over there was a Vietnamese major, so he kind of kept everything in line as far as that was concerned. And also, because being an American, I tried to do the right thing and not, you know, abuse them or show them the ugly American face or whatever. Then they liked me pretty well. No problem with that.
Did you like Vietnamese food?
You know, it wasn't bad. I kind of missed it when I got home. I had trouble eating hamburgers and whole food when I got home. I ate so much rice. In fact, for a long time, I couldn't eat any rice or chicken because I ate so much of it over there. But I kind of missed the rice and the flavoring on it. I still can taste it. And it was okay, and the water buffalo was okay, eel was okay, and fish was okay also. So that's basically it on the food. Their Vietnamese beer was called Ba Mi Ba. It's beer 33. Used to call it Panther Fist, and it was tasted about like that. But otherwise, their food was okay.
How did the anti-war demonstrations back in the U.S. affect your morale?
I think overall that had a big impact on us. I think it was a real, real, real bad problem, because we'd gone through the late 60s and Haight-Ashbury and the hippie movement, flower power and peace to the people and all of this, and was so tied up with the music like you hear all the time. And then you would go to training bases, like I went to intelligence school in Fort Hollenberg, Maryland. It's in Baltimore. We would go in and nobody seemed to really care. In fact, when I was in Oakland, getting ready to go over and ship out, was when they had the Kent State killings that came on the news. So about 2 hours later, we left for Vietnam, and we just did not know what to think about it. I think that even with that kind of flavor, most of us that weren't, you know, so easily persuaded, we thought the anti-war protesters were screwed up and weren't the right thing. We thought that going over there was the right thing to do at the time. But after being over there about 7 months, then we kind of look back and think, you know, maybe those people were right. You know, maybe the war should have been ended a lot earlier. But overall, my personal opinion on the anti-war stuff, the war turned out to be really screwed up, but I think that in the long run they really hurt the morale of the troops. And, you know, one of the things about it, a lot of people that I knew left and went to Canada and all this, and I'm so glad, you know, that I didn't do anything like that, because what am I going to tell my kids now? Well, I didn't want to go. My friends went, but I didn't have strong enough feeling, so I deserted to Canada. So, you know, I was glad I went ahead and did what I did, even though, as it turned out, it was a real mess.
What was it like to come home?
To come home was extremely tough. I had a double whammy. We used to talk about being caught with the culture over there and picking up a different set of values. And mine even had a double whammy, because I lived with the Vietnamese and I was away from the Americans. I guess coming home was the hardest thing to do. It was worse in some respects than being over there. I felt a a very, very deep sense of loss, of comradeship, brotherhood. I know that for weeks and months and even years after I got home, I picked up the paper and read every little thing that I could read about what was going on over there. My problem is I couldn't relate to people at all when I came back here. Here we had been in a life or death situation just about every day we were over here. And here's people that didn't even know where Vietnam was in a stage of fighting. They were doing, you know, material goods and entertainment, and something we've been deprived of for so long. And I just felt real empty and real cold for a long time. I came back to Tech and started graduate school. And I was like 26, 27 at the time. And I found out something I hadn't been before. And I was real, real high-tempered and wouldn't put up with very much. A lot of the little Tech gals I would date were 6, 7 years younger. And they'd tell me about their brother-in-law or so on and so forth, you know, was joined the National Guard, you know, wouldn't go or went to Canada, like I said a while ago. There's a lot of resentment on my part. I was not a very nice person when I came back. I couldn't communicate with people, and I couldn't relate, or I couldn't identify with them at all. So it was kind of bad news. You see all these movies about all these guys freaked out all the time. That never happened to me, but I felt really, really lonely. I felt displaced, and I felt really, really alone. I'd lost a lot of my feeling. It took a good number of years of trying to get it back.
You mentioned the Vietnamese culture. Tell me about it. What did you think about it? How is it different from American?
Difference in Vietnamese culture. They have the Cao Dai religion. They have the Buddhists. They have all of this. There's a good amount of them that were Catholic. Their culture toward home and just their manners and customs were really different. Even their body language was different. When I first got over there, I saw this sergeant out in the field waving at me, and I waved back and left because that's what that means over here. Over there, it means, come here quick, I'm in trouble. So maybe I probably should have gone over to help him. But it seemed like everything was just totally backwards from anything that we knew. Their body language, like in the movies, you always see them squatting down because they don't have chairs. To show you how their culture is, they believe in ancestor worship. And when you get away from the big metropolitan cities over there, the people they live in basically grass huts with grass on that. They cook their food over an open fire, and they have dirt floors in their little what we call hooches. And they slept on mats. And their education was just about zero. And the kids, their duty was to go to work and help the family out on the farm and the rice paddies. So all that couple just made it really a pretty alien culture to all of us.
Would you go back again if you had to?
Peacetime or wartime?
Wartime. Would you do it all over again?
Yeah, I think I would. I think that it's caused a lot of problems with me individually in relating to people. I'm doing better now than I did the first 4 or 5 years. There's no problem with it at all. I think my dealing with human relations are a little bit different than they were before I went. I don't think that I'm as kind or forgiving as I was before I went. But yeah, I'd do it all over again. In fact, peacetime-wise, I hope someday I'd like to go back and take a tour of that over there as a tourist. I definitely want to do that. Yeah, I'd really like to go back. I'm real anxious to... I'm sure the Vietnamese that I worked with are probably dead because of being in the intelligence and the top Phoenix program we were in, that my interpreter, I'm sure that after they got overrun, he was either beheaded or he's locked up in a hole in the ground somewhere. because anybody that worked with Americans on that kind of operation, they were really marked for dead. But yeah, I'd like to go back.
Are there any particular experiences that you'd like to relay? Anything that's come to mind?
As far as going back?
Anything, your experiences there, going back, retrospect?
I just think it was kind of like a frozen picture. It had this beautiful rolling, flat countryside with the rice paddies, and you see a guy out there with the plow and the water buffalo, and you'd see the American helicopters coming in above, and you'd see the little grass huts and stuff. But that's what sticks out more than anything for me. It's a real pretty country. But I tried to look at it differently than a lot of people. I guess that's about it.